Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. One of the first lessons that our kids learn in social studies class is how Americans chose a much different type of executive leadership than European countries. Instead of kings and queens, Americans elect presidents, mayors, and governors. But that doesn't mean that hereditary impulses are completely absent from our elections or our government. In Missouri alone, there are countless examples of sons, daughters, or spouses of elected officials running for office in their own right. And while some voters may be repelled by political dynasties, State Senator Jason Bean of Dunklin County says watching his dad serve in the Missouri House helped him become a better legislator.
One of the things I think that was so important with my dad is he represented his district. And, you know, once again, very Democratic district, one of the poorest districts in the state of Missouri. And I watched him represent his people.
But there is another type of familial political involvement that's not only frowned upon, it's straight up not allowed. Public officials hiring relatives for paid government jobs. Recently, St. Louis County Councilman Dennis Hancock, a Republican from Fenton, faced a lot of scrutiny after he sought to hire his stepdaughter as his assistant. That's not allowed by the Missouri Constitution, and even Hancock conceded he made a mistake.
I trust her, and she's capable, and she has all the requisite qualifications. It was just, you know, my mistake was I didn't realize that nepotism was at play there.
So do familial ties in politics make for better elected officials, or is it a source of enrichment and corruption? Joining us now to delve into this subject further is Cassandra Good, an associate professor at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia. Good is the author of the 2023 book, First Family, George Washington's Heirs and the Making of America. It's an in-depth look at how Washington's step-grandchildren use the first president's name to advance themselves in not so good ways. Welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks very much for having me.
Generational service in government and politics seems to be pretty common in the modern era in America. Was it considered normal in the earliest parts of American history?
Yes, certainly from even when America was colonies of Great Britain, there were a lot of family ties of people who were serving in offices. And then from the time that it became an independent country, there have been a lot of family ties among people in elected office, appointed office. If we think about even John Adams and John Quincy Adams, two of our early presidents were father and son. So this really goes back to the beginnings of the nation.
When John Quincy Adams ran for president after John Adams had served, from any research that you've done, how did Americans react to the possibility of having the child of a former president become president?
So most of the objections around John Quincy Adams were centered more around the idea that he was too much of an elite. It wasn't necessarily about critiques of the fact that this is a former president's son. I'm sure that there were some people bringing that up, but the real critique, especially when he was running in 1828 against Andrew Jackson, is this guy is an elitist, and even saying, and his wife is British. His wife was born in England, but was American. And so those were more along the lines of the critiques. I think it helped that John Quincy Adams had a very long political career before he ran for president. So it's not like he had never done anything and just is trading on his father's name. He already had like 3 decades of government service before he became president.
In terms of the presidential level, in addition to John Adams and John Quincy Adams, America elected both George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, and there's also been a grandfather-grandson combo with William Henry Harrison and Benjamin Harrison. But obviously, familial ties to politics often happens at a lower level than just the presidency. How common was it, especially in the early part of American history, for the son, daughter, spouse of like a mayor or congressperson to try and run and succeed the person that was in office?
Well, certainly in early America, we're not going to have daughters or wives.
It's a very good point, but continue.
So you're not going to have that, but I think, you know, even if you look at state legislatures, if you look at judges, all sorts of positions. And it's not just that this is, oh, I can run for office because a family member has been in office. You have people that are socialized into political life. They're growing up in a family where if their parent is a political figure, they know other political figures, they know how the system works. So they have that particular political capital that they have built up just being in a political family, in addition to the name recognition and the connections. So I think it's natural that that would happen. The real difference is with appointed positions, where somebody is appointing a family member to a position, and that was seen as something inappropriate and corrupt in early America.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Has it always been the case that an elected official appointing their relative to some governmental position has always been associated with corruption?
I would say it's even broader than that. The idea of appointing somebody that you were friends with or had other special connections with was even seen as corrupt in this period. Now, it happened, at least those patronage appointments of, you know, a friend is writing and saying, can you help me get a job, or can you help a friend get a position? And it might be something like a lighthouse keeper, basically a small patronage position. It might be ambassador to another country. That was pretty common. But in terms of appointing family members to positions, so that more strict definition of nepotism, that was something that people really worried even more about and was not as common. And so we see with George Washington, both friends and even his nephew are writing to him when he becomes president to say, hey, do you think you could appoint me to this position? And he over and over again says, that would look bad. People are going to be watching me closely, and I cannot even have the appearance of corruption.
But according to your book, some of his step-grandchildren definitely tried to profit off of the fact that they were tangentially related to the first president of the United States. Can you talk a little bit about that and how, I guess, this was the first big example of relatives trying to use a famous president to their advantage?
Absolutely. So his step-grandchildren, and just to explain who they are, because most people think of, you know, George Washington, father of the country, didn't have any children. His wife, Martha, had been married before and had two kids from that marriage. And her son then had four children. So those are the step-grandchildren. And the Washingtons actually sort of unofficially adopted the two younger ones. But all four of them were raised with George and Martha Washington. And their last name is Custis. So the Custis grandkids, three of the four were girls, so they couldn't run for office. I think it seems entirely possible that if they could have, they would have. But they are able to benefit in other ways. There's other forms of power through, you know, just having connections to important people in power. They had influence in that way. They had a lot of social clout. And so they still got political and social power from that relationship. And they are just constantly reminding people that George Washington was their adopted father, and giving away things that George Washington had given them or that came from Mount Vernon, just to remind people over and over again of that Washington family tie. So they are famous, they are celebrities for being George Washington's children. And that really makes sort of careers for all four of them.
One of the other trends I've noticed is that there are some children of presidents that end up serving in cabinet level capacities after their father's tenure in office elapsed. So a good example of this is Abraham Lincoln's son serving as Secretary of War under Presidents Garfield and Arthur, or James Garfield's son serving as Secretary of the Interior under President Roosevelt. But Lincoln and Garfield were both deceased by the time those sons became cabinet members. So it's not like their direct influence allowed these two people to get their jobs. How do you think situations like that happen where they're obviously related to a former president, but the president himself is just obviously can't exert any influence because the president is deceased?
Part of it there is just name recognition. And what I was saying before about being socialized into the political scene, that these are people that naturally are going to know more about politics, be more inclined perhaps towards a political career, and have connections. So I think it is, in a sense, not just about favoritism, but that these people actually may know more from having been raised in this setting about politics and be more inclined to it than people who are not related to politicians. And, you know, if we look at early American history in particular, there's a pretty small elite population at that point. And it is largely elite people who are serving in politics. So you're going to have, you know, it's kind of natural at that point that you're going to have some people with family connections that over generations are staying in power just because of the small set of elites at the beginning.
I'm curious, given that, like, one of the basic things that children learn in American history class is that America adopted an executive leadership style that was markedly different than European leadership, i.e., like, they elected presidents instead of having, like, kings and queens. Was there any, like, general revulsion to the idea that family members should have generational legacies in politics because they wanted to continue to reject what happened in European countries? Or was that not really a factor?
It's certainly a factor with George Washington, because when he becomes when it becomes clear he's going to be the first president, there's actually a newspaper article in 1788 that had a list of all the reasons he's a good person to be the first president. And one of the items on that list is, as having no son and therefore not exposing us to the danger of an hereditary successor. So this idea, this fear about a king and hereditary power, people feel better about the fact that George Washington may have nephews and this adopted grandson, but he doesn't have a direct heir. And in fact, Washington also mentions this in a draft of his first inaugural address, that he doesn't have a son who could take power after him.
So let's flash forward to present day. Missouri's constitution states as follows: any public officer or employee in this state who by virtue of his office or employment names or appoints to public office or employment any relative within the fourth degree by consanguinity or affinity shall thereby forfeit his office or employment. Now, I understand you probably have not, like, intensely studied every anti-nepotism statute throughout the entire country, but from what I just read, is that a pretty common thing in other states? Or are there states with no such direct prohibition on directly appointing a relative to a paid governmental position?
It's interesting. Each state determines this on its own. There's nothing in the Constitution about this. And so some states, like Missouri, have rules on this. They have various, you mentioned any relative within the fourth degree, and consanguinity, that's the blood relation, or affinity by marriage. And so some of them will have different degrees of relationship. They also have different levels of penalties. So in Alabama, for example, it is a misdemeanor to do this that could be punished by anywhere from a $500 fine to imprisonment for a year. So there's variation within these laws. And then there are many states that have no provisions at all on nepotism. They do have general conflict of interest laws, but the state where I live, Virginia, has no such law. California, Delaware, Illinois, none of those states have laws on the book specifically about nepotism.
So just to put forth a hypothetical, if Governor Glenn Youngkin wanted to appoint his son to a paid governmental position within his staff. There's nothing within Virginia law that would punish him or prevent him from doing that.
There's not a specific statute. I don't know if people would try to use some kind of conflict of interest statutes, but I mean, we can even see in the last presidential administration when President Trump appointed his daughter and son-in-law to positions in the White House as advisors, there was some debate over whether that was legal or not. There is a federal anti-nepotism statute from 1967 that's in part a reaction to when John F. Kennedy appointed his brother Robert as Attorney General. But that statute has been interpreted as not including either the president or the executive office. So certainly there's, even when laws are on the books, there is room for interpretation. And I do think in many states that would be legally just fine to do.
Yeah, you mentioned John F. Kennedy appointing Robert F. Kennedy as Attorney General, which I was not alive then. I was negative 30 years old when that occurred. But I do know from reading in history that was not universally beloved as a move. And nepotism was brought up. And I think that even Robert F. Kennedy knew that that was going to be a mark against him. He still got confirmed. He was Attorney General. Was there any other instances where, like, a president, like, tried to appoint, like, a brother or a son like that? Or was that really unprecedented in presidential history from what you've researched?
I have not come across other examples of that happening. It may well have. This is clearly a high enough profile one that it caused Congress to take action. But Congress also was worried about the fact that at the time, plenty of congressmen had family members working in their congressional offices as well, which is now barred by that law. Although there is a workaround on that too, which is quite common, and that is that many congresspeople have family members working on their campaign staff.
Which actually is a case in St. Louis. Congresswoman Cori Bush engendered some controversy because she employed her husband to do security work for her, but he was paid by the campaign. But that wasn't actually that unusual. Like, Lacey Clay, the congressman that Cori Bush defeated, paid his sister to basically run all of his campaigns over the years. And Russ Carnahan, who was also a former congressman, had his wife on as an advisory role. My understanding is that's allowed as long as you're paying fair market value to the person and the person's actually doing work, i.e. you can't pay your husband $3 million to, like, write a speech for you. It has to be comparable to what you pay a speechwriter, from my understanding.
Yes, that's correct. And congressmen actually have to sort of sign something certifying that they are not employing any family members in their offices. But again, the campaign is a separate money source from the federal positions.
There is also another workaround to anti-nepotism statutes, getting some other elected official to hire your son, daughter, spouse in their county, state, federal position. Was that a common, obviously, I don't know if there were, like, specific anti-nepotism statutes in, like, the early 1800s or even the 1900s, but that seems like that seems like something that is probably very hard to combat. Even if you have an elected official asking another elected official to hire somebody, what about that as a workaround to some of the anti-nepotism provisions that we've talked about?
Well, and that could fall more under the sort of patronage heading that I mentioned before that Americans in early America did think of as being corrupt, that if you were petitioning an elected official to appoint somebody else related to you or a friend of yours, that's still considered improper, but it was not illegal. And most of these anti-nepotism laws were not on the books in early America. And, you know, one early example I can think of here is if we go back to George Washington, his nephew, Bushrod Washington, had asked George Washington for an appointment as a district attorney. And that's where George Washington said, no, I can't do that. It would look bad. But after Washington retired under the next president, John Adams, Bushrod Washington was appointed to the Supreme Court as a Supreme Court justice. And we might look at that and say, oh, that looks bad. But in fact, It doesn't seem that George Washington was involved in that appointment, and Bushrod Washington wrote a letter to George Washington apologizing, basically, for taking that position, because he knew that George actually wanted him to run for Congress. And at the time, being a Supreme Court justice was not very prestigious. So we have this example here. This is, you know, under President John Adams, but in fact, while it might look like nepotism, it does not appear to have been.
So we've talked a lot about the drawbacks of having family members participate in the political and governmental process. Have you found that there are any benefits to the general public, not necessarily to the family members themselves, of having sort of these familial ties, either in elected offices or appointed offices?
Well, I think that if you're looking for people who understand how the political system works and have some experience with the system, then that could be seen as a benefit. Many voters now want to vote for people that have nothing to do with the system. That can also be seen as a negative, because how will they know how to navigate it? On the other hand, they could bring different ideas. So it's partially a matter of perspective there, and also a matter of whether that family member actually is qualified. So if we go back to the John Quincy Adams example, this is somebody who not only had grown up around politics, had been in many, many different positions throughout his career before he was elected president. And so he's clearly qualified in addition to having that family background. And so I think when those things go together, it can be a benefit because of having that knowledge. But again, it's partially a matter of perspective.
One of the things that I read, particularly about John F. Kennedy's appointment of Robert F. Kennedy as Attorney General, is JFK believed that RFK would give him unfiltered, honest counsel that may not have been possible with somebody who was not related to him. I just finished up a book about RFK's recounting of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which he was a major part of. And I think that I don't know if John F. Kennedy has written or spoke about this aspect of that crisis, but I think it was probably comforting to John F. Kennedy to have Robert F. Kennedy in the trenches with him during that extremely pivotal moment in history. What do you think about that phenomenon, that having a relative, admittingly in a usual situation like a presidential cabinet, could make decision-making more fluid and more honest?
I would say that to me would be outweighed by the fact that you would worry about whether that person could be fully honest or critical of a family member. Anybody who appoints you can also dismiss you and has some power over you. And in a family relationship, I think that adds another layer of complication. And so while there might be more trust and comfort, there's also a question of transparency. How much honesty are you actually going to get from that person? And will they be willing to disagree with you if they need to?
Cassandra Good is an associate professor at Marymount University and the author of First Family, George Washington's Heirs and the Making of America. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's episode was produced by Jason Rosenbaum.
And by our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.